Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine having the absolute perfect words to instantly cure someone's grief.
Oh, that would be incredible.
Right. You know exactly what to say, the precise tonal inflection to use, and, well, the exact conceptual framework needed to reach into their mind and untangle their suffering.
Yes.
But at the exact same moment, you deliver this flawless, life-altering sentence. Mm. You exist in a state of knowing that the words themselves are entirely empty.
Mm-hmm.
They're completely devoid of inherent meaning. You're like drawing a picture in the open sky.
It is. It's a stunning paradox when you really sit with it.
It really is.
The idea that ultimate eloquence, I mean, the very pinnacle of communication does not come from grasping at language. It actually comes from completely releasing our conceptual hold on it.
Right.
This is where the friction of our ordinary human experience meets the profound expanse of the Mahayana view.
Exactly.
We spend our lives struggling to communicate, you know, building these rigid brick walls of vocabulary to defend our ideas. And yet true spiritual articulacy arises only when we realize the wall was never there to begin with.
That is perfectly stated. Welcome to you listening to this deep dive into the source material.
We are so glad you're here with us.
Today, we are exploring a breathtaking 1,200-year-old Tibetan text that claims to hold the secret to that exact paradoxical state.
Yes, we are looking closely at In Praise of the Glorious Goddess Sarasvati, or in Tibetan, the Pal, La Muskalad Byangs La Butpa.
And we have access to this profound piece of spiritual technology because of the ongoing monumental translation work of the 84,000 Project.
Which is such a massive undertaking.
It really is. Specifically, this translation comes to us from Lowell Cook and the Tsubashita Translation Group.
Right, and the 84,000 Project's mission to translate the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern languages provides the crucial foundation for everything we are about to discuss today.
Absolutely.
To sit with this text in English, it's not just an academic exercise for us, it is an encounter with a living tradition.
Yes, very much so.
Our mission today is to systematically trace the philosophical architecture of this praise. We want to understand how a practitioner uses these specific verses to transform ordinary, clumsy speech into the flawless, compassionate eloquence of an awakened being.
And to really understand that architecture, we have to look at the ground it is built upon.
We do.
If you are familiar with South Asian history, you know the name Sarasvati immediately evokes a massive pan-Indic presence.
Oh, absolutely. She's everywhere.
Right. She is not an exclusively Buddhist figure. Her presence is woven deeply through Brahmanical traditions, Jain traditions, tracing all the way back to her Vedic origins as the personification of a purifying river.
Mm-hmm.
Over centuries, that purifying flow became the flow of intellect, the flow of music, and the flow of language itself.
She is universally recognized as the patroness of arts and intellect across all those traditions.
Sure.
But when we encounter her here within the specific framework of the great vehicle, the Mahayana, we are not looking at a simple cultural borrowing.
No, not at all.
The Buddhist tradition doesn't just adopt deities. It fundamentally recontextualizes their ontology and their purpose.
That's a crucial distinction.
In a conventional worldly setting, a devotee might petition Sarasvati to compose a brilliant poem, or, you know, to pass a grueling civil service examination.
Or to win a high-stakes philosophical debate.
Exactly. The goal in those contexts is the acquisition of worldly skill.
It is about enhancing the ego's toolkit, basically.
Yeah.
It's intelligence for the sake of personal dominance or aesthetic pleasure.
Precisely. But within the Mahayana, the entire trajectory of practice is governed by the bodhisattva intention.
The resolve to free all beings.
Yes. That uncompromising resolve to achieve perfect awakening solely to liberate all sentient beings from the cycle of suffering.
Right.
When Sarasvati is invoked within this space, her gifts of eloquence and unimpeded memory are entirely stripped of worldly ambition.
They have to be.
They are transmuted into the indispensable surgical tools of compassion. An awakened being requires perfect speech, because perfectly tailored communication is how the Dharma is transmitted.
That distinction completely alters the gravity of the text for me.
It changes everything.
It really does. And speaking to that gravity, well, we have to address this text's rather extraordinary classification.
Yes, the canonical placement.
Right. When we look at the Tibetan canon, we are looking at two distinct oceans of literature. You have the Kangyur and the Tangyur.
Mm-hmm.
Now, We know there are beautiful praises to Sarasvati written by great Indian masters like Suradhar and legendary Tibetan masters like Tsongkhapa.
Very famous praises, yes.
But those sit in the Tenjir. That's the collection of translated treatises and commentaries authored by highly realized yet definitively human scholars.
Right.
This text, however, sits squarely in the Kangir.
Which means it is classified as Buddha Vakana, the authentic word of the Buddha. The compilers of the Tibetan canon made a very deliberate decision here. By placing this praise in the Kangir, they are asserting that these verses are not the product of a human intellect admiring the divine.
Wow.
They are an emanation of awakened intent itself. It carries the absolute authoritative weight of a root tantric revelation.
Yet, when we dig into the historical provenance of this specific text, that absolute authority is cloaked in a lot of shadows.
It is quite mysterious.
It is. The translator's introduction notes that we do not have a Sanskrit title for this work.
No.
Nor do we have any surviving Sanskrit witness. No. We only have the Tibetan translation.
Right. It appears twice in the Kangir, once in the Action Tantra section, and once in the Compendium of Dhurans.
But here is the historical anomaly that just fascinates me.
What's that?
We have the Denkarma and the Fengfengma. These are the great imperial catalogs from the 8th and 9th centuries that meticulously recorded the state-sponsored translations of the Tibetan Empire.
Very rigorous records.
Exactly. And this text isn't in them.
No, it's missing.
It's also entirely absent from the massive cache of ancient manuscripts sealed in the Dunhuang Caves.
Mm-hmm.
So, if this is the word of the Buddha, why is it missing from the earliest, most rigorous records of transmission? Does a lack of early provenance weaken its standing as a root text?
It's a brilliant historical provocation.
Thank you.
From a strict materialist historical view, the absence in the imperial catalogs and the lack of a translator's colophon might suggest it was a later, perhaps indigenous Tibetan composition retroactively attributed to the Buddha.
Right, a later edition.
But within the internal logic of the tradition, this absence tells a very different, deeply compelling story.
Oh, how so?
The translator suggests this text was likely translated during the period of fragmentation. That period stretches roughly from the mid-8th to the late 10th centuries.
So after the collapse of the Tibetan Empire and the assassination of King Langdharma.
Exactly. The centralized state-sponsored monastic institutions were essentially shattered. The massive translation committees that produced the Denkarma catalog no longer existed. But the Dharma did not disappear. It went underground. It was preserved in secret by lay yogis, wandering ascetics, and hidden family lineages.
I see.
When texts are transmitted through these decentralized, highly secretive tantric networks, they don't get stamped with official state colophons. They are passed directly from guru to disciple.
That makes perfect sense.
So the lack of a paper trail doesn't necessarily invalidate its authenticity. Rather, it points to a text that survived the darkest period of Tibetan history through the sheer vital force of dedicated practitioners, only to be formalized into the Kangyur when the canon was systematically compiled centuries later.
It survived in the minds of the practitioners before it was ever locked into the formal architecture of the canon.
Beautifully said.
That historical resilience beautifully mirrors the actual teachings within the text. If we turn to the opening verses, we see immediately how it grounds the practitioner.
Yes, it sets the stage perfectly.
But it doesn't start with a plea for intelligence. It starts with the ultimate orientation of the mind. Let's look at verse 1.1.
Let's hear it.
Quote, "In the path that leads to awakening, the victors and their heirs, masters of the Dharma, and the multitudes of wisdom mantalas, arranged in successive levels of knowing, in these we seek refuge."
Such a profound opening.
It is. We are so used to the standard Mahayana refuge formula, you know, taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
Right.
But this phrasing, the multitudes of wisdom mantalas arranged in successive levels of knowing, it feels far more structural, almost architectural to me.
It is a deeply mechanical and profound rendering of refuge.
How do you mean?
Well, the successive levels of knowing is translating the concept of the bhumis. The 10 specific stages of realization a bodhisattva must traverse.
Ah, the bodhisattva levels.
Right. And wisdom mentalis in a tantric context does not just mean a flat two-dimensional diagram. It refers to the fully perfected multi-divisional environments and retinues of awakened beings.
Oh, that's fascinating.
By phrasing refuge this way, the text is pulling the practitioner into an active, progressive epistemology. You are not just surrendering to a higher power. You are cognitively aligning yourself with the exact structural blueprint of a fully awakened mind. You are taking refuge in the process of your own inevitable evolution.
And having established that evolutionary blueprint, the text directly addresses the goddess in verse 1.2.
Yes.
Quote, "Homage to you, glorious goddess Sarasvati. Your mastery over speech is renowned throughout the world, and you have transcended the three knowledges of the sages. All of this is the result of your vast conduct."
Mm-hmm.
I want to pause on that line. Transcended the three knowledges of the sages. The translation notes indicate that the sages translates the Sanskrit word if.
Yeah, the seers.
And the three knowledges likely refers to the three original Vedas. This seems like a very sharp epistemological boundary being drawn.
It certainly is.
It's taking the absolute pinnacle of orthodox worldly spiritual knowledge, the Vedas, and explicitly positioning Sarasvati's realization beyond them.
It is a decisive philosophical demarcation. The ancient ice were the seers who cognized the fundamental truths of the Brahmanical universe. But from the Madhyamaka perspective, the middle way perspective, no matter how subtle or refined Vedic knowledge is, it is ultimately still bound by the conceptual dualism of self and other.
Because it still assumes a self.
Exactly. It remains within the architecture of samsara. By stating she has transcended these knowledges, the text clarifies that her eloquence does not stem from a mastery of worldly scripture.
I see.
Her speech is an unmediated expression of emptiness in bodhicitta.
And the mechanism for reaching that unmediated expression is entirely grounded in action. The verse concludes, "All of this is the result of your vast conduct."
Action is everything here.
Which leads seamlessly into verse 1.3. Quote, "You take up the burden of immense activities and joyfully endure every hardship for the benefit of beings, coursing through the levels and the 10 perfections, and standing steadfast in stores of virtue, you take whatever form is needed."
Mm-hmm.
This shatters the ivory tower illusion of intellect. Her eloquence isn't forged in a quiet library of abstract meditation.
Not at all.
It is forged in the grueling, absolute messiness of the world. She joyfully endures every hardship. Her ability to speak perfectly is a direct result of being in the trenches with suffering beings.
That is the very essence of the 10 perfections, or paramitas.
With the transcendent virtues.
Exactly. We often treat the perfections, you know, generosity, discipline, patience, joyful effort, concentration, wisdom, and so on, as just a checklist of good behaviors.
Like a moral to-do list.
Right. But here, they are the very refiner's fire that produces perfect speech. If you have spent eons practicing absolute patience with hostile beings, your speech will naturally lack the sharp edges of defensiveness.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
If you have perfected generosity, your words will never be withheld out of spite. The psychological friction that makes our ordinary communication so clumsy and inadequate is entirely burned away by this vast conduct.
Wow.
Therefore, when she speaks, there is zero distortion between her boundless compassion and the words that manifest in the listener's mind.
That complete lack of distortion brings us to the visual poetry of the text. Because this isn't just a philosophical treatise.
No, it's a practice.
Right. It is a Kriya Tantra, an action tantra practice. The practitioner isn't meant to merely read these words. They are meant to generate a living image of the goddess in their mind's eye.
Visualization is key.
Verses 1.4 and 1.5 give us the blueprint for that visualization. Quote, "Your rounded face is the flawless moon in full. Your lustrous eyes of compassion open the eyes of others, as you gaze at length upon every last universe, effortlessly. It is before you that the likes of Devendra and Brahma bow down, compassionate mother, replete with love and patience. It is your delight, noble goddess, to nurture every single being."
The imagery is stunning.
It really is. And I want to examine the mechanics of this. We know that in Action Tantra, visualizing the form of the deity is a primary method for purifying the mind stream.
Yes.
But how exactly does picturing face like a flawless moon or lustrous eyes function beyond mere aesthetic concentration?
In the tantric view, form and emptiness are not in opposition. They are co-emergent.
Okay, unpack that a little.
Well, a fully awakened being has eliminated all dualistic obscurations, which means their physical form is no longer generated by karmic-propelled ignorance. Their form is the pure, visible manifestation of their accumulated merit.
So the appearance is the merit.
Yes. When the text instructs you to visualize her face as a flawless full moon, it is not utilizing a poetic trope. It is a specific technology.
How so?
The moon represents the cooling, peaceful nature of enlightenment that pacifies the scorching heat of afflictive emotions. By visualizing that exact cooling luminosity, the practitioner's own subtle nervous system, their inner winds and channels, begins to mirror that pacification.
That is profound.
You are literally tuning your physiological and cognitive state to the frequency of her realized patience.
So the visual form is both a diagnostic tool and a tuning fork.
That's a great way to put it.
But then we hit a line that, well, if Miss Reed feels like it drops the vibration entirely. The text says, "It is before you that the likes of Devendra and Brahma bow down."
Ah, yes.
And later in verse 1.6, "Even extremist scholars bow down before you." When I read that, it's easy to cringe slightly.
It can sound a bit tribal.
Right. It sounds like ancient sectarian triumphalism. Our goddess makes your top gods bow down.
I know we aren't supposed to take this as petty rivalry, but how should a practitioner understand this hierarchy without falling into spiritual pride?
It is a vital question, because clinging to sectarian superiority is itself a massive obscuration.
Exactly.
To understand this, we have to look at what Devendra, an epithet for Indra and Brahma, actually signify within Buddhist cosmology.
Okay.
They are not merely rival deities. They are archetypes of the absolute limits of cyclic existence. Indra represents the apex of the desire realm. He embodies the maximum threshold of sensory pleasure, aesthetic beauty, and worldly political power.
The peak of worldly enjoyment. Yes. And Brahma presides over the form realm. He represents the maximum threshold of worldly meditative absorption, deep states of concentration, and serenity.
So they are the absolute ceiling of what a being can achieve while still being fundamentally ignorant of the nature of reality.
Exactly. And the extremist scholars, the Tirthikas, represent the apex of conceptual dualistic philosophy. They possess the sharpest intellects capable of navigating worldly truth.
Right.
So when the text describes these three entities bowing to Sarasvati, it is establishing a profound ontological hierarchy, not a tribal one.
That reframes it completely.
It is a stark reminder to the practitioner. You can achieve unimaginable wealth and pleasure like Indra. You can achieve states of profound, unshakable tranquility like Brahma. You can possess an intellect that can debate any scholar to a standstill. But if those achievements are not rooted in the realization of emptiness and dedicated to the liberation of all beings, they are ultimately useless. They will end. They are still trapped in suffering. They bow to her because her realization completely transcends the parameters of their reality.
It is a safeguard against the practitioner settling for lesser goals.
Precisely.
If you start acquiring the eloquence of Sarasvati, you might be tempted to use it to become an extremist scholar, dominating debates and acquiring fame. The text preempts that by showing the greatest scholar bowing to the Bodhisattva.
The intellect must serve the awakening.
The intellect must serve the awakening. I love that. This brings us to the actual mechanics of what the practitioner is requesting. Verses 1.6 and 1.7 lay out the petition.
Let's read them.
Quote, "Wielding mastery over fields of knowledge, you are the patroness of words. As you are the god of all gods in the universe and a supreme companion who endeavors to dispel our suffering, even extremist scholars bow down before you. Your limbs are well proportioned and your voice is ever sweet. Poised with majesty, you glow with flawless qualities and merit. As it is you who grants the accomplishments of the highest knowledge, grant us swift intellect, retention of words, and eloquence most supreme."
Retention of words.
Yes, retention of words. That is translating the incredibly dense Tibetan term zungs, which itself translates the Sanskrit dharan.
Mm-hmm.
When I try to conceptualize dharan, I used to think of it like an infinitely massive, perfectly cataloged internal library. A photographic memory where you can just walk down the stacks and pull out the exact sutra you need.
That's a very common way to think about it.
But the more I sit with these texts, the more that library metaphor feels wrong.
Mm-hmm.
A library is static. It's dead information. Dharan seems much more vital, more alive. I started thinking of it more like an immunological response.
Oh, I find that analogy deeply compelling. Walk me through the mechanics of that.
Well, the human immune system doesn't function by consciously memorizing millions of diseases in a static database.
Right.
Instead, it holds a profound systemic intelligence. When its specific pathogen enters the body, the immune system dynamically and spontaneously generates the exact, precise antibody required to neutralize that specific threat at that exact moment.
Yeah.
It is a living, responsive retention of biological truth. When we petition for dawn, are we not asking for something similar?
We absolutely are.
Not a static encyclopedia of Dharma, but a mind so fully integrated with the truth of emptiness that the exact teaching required to cure the specific suffering of the person in front of us spontaneously arises.
That is a phenomenal articulation of the mechanism. If we look at the historical context of early Buddhism, memory was literally the survival mechanism of the Dharma.
Before it was written down.
Exactly. Before texts were written down, monks had to memorize vast amounts of teachings. But even then, Dharan was recognized as something far beyond ordinary synaptic recall.
Right.
As your analogy perfectly captures, ordinary memory is subject to decay, and more importantly, it is subject to the clumsy conceptual retrieval process of the ego.
We try to remember things to sound smart.
Exactly. We try to sound smart, or we misapply a teaching because we misjudge the situation. Dharan, as a supreme accomplishment, bypasses the conceptual ego entirely.
How does it do that?
Because the practitioner has realized emptiness, there is no self trying to remember an object. There is only the vast space of awareness. And when that awareness encounters the suffering of another being, the exact perfect words, the antibody to their specific ignorance, arise spontaneously, without friction, without premeditation.
That dynamic spontaneous responsiveness illuminates the profound nature of her mastery, described in verses 1.8 through 1.10.
Let's hear the verses.
Quote, "With the welfare of every being always in your heart, eminent and unfailing goddess, you dwell in liberation. Firm in your promises, you consider with grace those who call upon you, and you fulfill their every wish. As the master of sound, you capture in words everything that appears in the universe. You are understood by all and skilled in expression. O Sarasvati, your capabilities are inconceivable. Wielding mastery over the might of Zerold and Dharma, you, a capable Olean, have genuinely mastered the Samaya."
That term Samaya is so important here.
Yes. Translated in Tibetan as Damchig, you have genuinely mastered the Samaya. We often translate Samaya as a vow or a pledge, but in this context, it feels less like a promise someone makes and more like an immutable law of physics that she embodies.
Yes, framing it merely as a promise introduces a subtle dualism, as if she could choose to break it but politely declines.
Right, like she's just being very well behaved.
Exactly. In the tantric path, Samaya is the absolute inextricable bond between the nature of reality, the practitioner, and the enlightened action.
Oh, that's beautiful.
For a fully realized being, mastering the Samaya means their neural architecture, their karmic momentum, and their fundamental awareness are so completely fused with the bodhicitta, the desire to liberate beings, that acting selfishly or withholding the Dharma is as ontologically impossible as fire deciding to be cold.
Wow.
Her mastery of the Samaya guarantees that her inconceivable capabilities with sound and expression will never, for a single moment, be used for anything other than liberation.
And it is precisely that unbreakable, selfless bond that the practitioner must adopt when making the central request of this text. This brings us to verse 1.11, which acts as the ultimate safety valve for this entire practice.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, "You are admired by all for your conduct of supreme awakening. Blessed Lady, please continue always to grant the supreme purpose to those who desire the boon of pure body, speech, and mind, with which to bring about the perfect benefit of beings."
Such a crucial condition.
It completely rewires the intention of the practitioner. You cannot chant this text effectively if you are secretly hoping it will make you a famous author or charismatic influencer.
No, you cannot.
You are explicitly asking for the tools of eloquence only to bring about the perfect benefit of beings.
It is the ultimate safeguard. If you approach a practice of power without the anchor of bodhicitta, that power will merely inflate your ego and deepen your suffering. The text demands a radical honesty. You must align your intention perfectly with her Samaya. You are asking for a pure body, speech, and mind so that you can become a transparent conduit for her enlightened activity.
Which leads right into verse 1.12, finalizing this request.
What does it say?
Quote, "Help us to be brave as we strive along the path to awakening. Let our tongues be quick and our words be righteous. Endow us with treasuries of knowledge and speech unobstructed. Allow us to achieve the full eloquence of all the well-gone ones."
The well-gone ones, the Sugatas.
Yes, a beautiful epithet for the Buddhas, those who have elegantly and perfectly traversed the path. We are asking to speak exactly as a Buddha speaks.
Exactly.
Now, at this point, the text could simply end. The foundation has been laid, the visualization generated, the bodhisattva intention solidified, and the ultimate request made.
It feels complete.
It does. But instead of concluding, the text introduces a massive philosophical rupture. It pulls the rug out from under the entire conceptual framework we just spent 12 verses building.
Yes, here comes the pivot.
Verse 1.13, quote, "Mother of knowledge, your nature is devoid of conceptuality. The flag of your reputation flutters in the winds of joy, like wanting to draw a picture in the sky. Your attributes are hard to comprehend. Your qualities are boundless.
It's breathtaking.
We have spent this entire time assigning her attributes. A face like the moon, sweet voice, boundless compassion, swift intellect. And suddenly, we are told her nature is devoid of conceptuality, and that describing her is like wanting to draw a picture in the sky. Why build this intricate conceptual architecture only to instantly dismantle it?
Because that dismantling is the direct experience of Madhyamaka, the middle way.
Explain that for us.
If the text only gave us the majestic form and the sweet voice, we would grasp at Sarasvati as a truly existent, external, solid deity. We would turn her into an object of dualistic worship, which fundamentally traps us in samsara.
Right, we'd be solidifying her.
But if the text only told us she was empty and devoid of conceptuality, we might fall into nihilism, believing there is no path, no compassion, and no ability to act in the world.
The two extremes.
Exactly. The brilliance of this text is how it forces the union of the two truths. The relative and the ultimate, like wanting to draw a picture in the sky.
Such a powerful image.
Consider the physical reality of the sky. It is unobstructed. It has no edges, no boundaries, no inherent color, no localized center. It is vast and accommodating.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to draw a hard conceptual line on the sky will not hold it. Concepts like self, other, subject, object are lines we try to draw in the empty expanse of reality. The ultimate nature of the goddess and the ultimate nature of the practitioner's own mind is that unobstructed sky.
It refuses to hold the lines we try to impose on it.
Exactly. But here is the profound secret of Mahayana compassion. It is only because the sky is empty and unobstructed that all the phenomena of the universe, the clouds, the weather systems, the birds, the light of the sun, can manifest within it.
Oh, that's beautiful.
If the sky were solid rock, nothing could move. Because Sarasvati's ultimate nature is completely devoid of conceptuality, because she does not hold a single rigid line of ego or identity, her relative manifestation can be infinitely responsive. Her qualities are boundless precisely because she has no boundary.
Her emptiness is not a void. It is the very capacity for her endless eloquence.
Yes.
When an ordinary person speaks, we speak from a place of solidity. We identify fiercely with our opinions. Our words are heavy defensive bricks.
We all know that feeling.
But when she speaks, her words are like rainbows appearing in the empty sky. They are vividly apparent, intensely beautiful, perfectly functional in their ability to communicate and soothe. But if you try to grasp them, they are entirely empty of inherent existence.
That is the perfection of speech. To communicate the Dharma with absolute precision and devastating compassion, while simultaneously resting in the direct realization that neither the speaker, nor the words, nor the listener inherently exists.
And realizing that conceptual language has reached its absolute limit, the text abandons translated poetry altogether.
Right into the mantra.
Verse 1.14 delivers the pure sonic essence, the mantra. Namo Bhagavate Brahme. Namasarasvate Devi Sijantu Mantrapadam Brahmanu Mantra Swaha. The translators provide the literal rendering. Quote, homage to the Lord Brahma. Homage to Sarasvati, goddess. May this mantra formula be accomplished. Let it be consecrated by Brahma Swaha.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When we chant a mantra at the climax of a text like this, we are no longer processing information. We are not analyzing grammar or unpacking metaphors. We are utilizing the sound itself to resonate with the empty, unobstructed nature we just recognized.
It bypasses the conceptual intellect entirely.
It vibrates at the frequency of Dharma.
The mantra is the distillation of the entire text. It is the architectural blueprint of the wisdom mantra collapsed into a single resonant formula.
A sonic seed.
Exactly. When a practitioner recites this, holding the bodhisattva intention and resting in the recognition of the sky-like nature of mind, the friction of ordinary speech dissolves.
Verse 1.15 seals the transmission, stating simply, quote, this concludes in praise of the glorious goddess Sarasvati.
A profound journey.
Looking back over the vast terrain of this text, it is staggering how much spiritual technology is compressed into 15 short verses. We examined its mysterious origins during Tibet's dark period of fragmentation, recognizing how hidden lineages kept the Dharma alive when institutions fell.
Mm-hmm.
We unpacked the active evolutionary nature of taking refuge in the wisdom mantras.
We saw how the Kriya Tantra visualizations of her majestic form are not mere poetry, but precise diagnostic tools to align our own subtle physiology with the cooling, pacifying reality of enlightenment.
Right.
We recognize the profound hierarchy that subjugates the highest worldly achievements, the power of Indra, the serenity of Brahma, the intellect of the extremist scholars to the ultimate supremacy of selfless liberation.
We redefined Dürren, moving past the concept of a static library, to understand it as a dynamic, spontaneous, immunological response to the suffering of beings.
Yeah.
And finally, we confronted the breathtaking paradox of the middle way, that the perfection of form and eloquence arises only from a mind that is entirely devoid of conceptuality, resting like an open sky.
When we study a text like this, you know, the responsibility shifts to us. It forces a rigorous self-examination of our own daily conduct.
How do you mean?
Well, how much unnecessary friction are we creating with our words? Are we using our intellect to build thicker, heavier walls of conceptual identity? Or are we slowly learning to dissolve those walls, allowing a more genuine, spontaneous compassion to flow through our interactions?
That's the real test. We live in an era that is completely suffocated by noise. We are drowning in a relentless torrent of communication hot takes, endless text messages, fractured media, defensive posturing.
It's overwhelming.
We consume and generate millions of words, yet the fundamental isolation and suffering of the human condition remains untouched by all that chatter. We're desperately trying to draw permanent pictures in a sky that refuses to hold them. So as we close this deep dive, I want you to sit with a very specific imagination. What would it physically and mentally feel like to cultivate a Quran of the heart in the midst of your deeply chaotic life?
Just imagine that.
Imagine moving through your day, entering into conversations, debates, and moments of conflict, but completely dropping the frantic, anxious need to conceptually defend yourself.
Letting the walls down.
Imagine responding to the people around you, not from a rigid database of opinions, but from a vast, accommodating spaciousness. Imagine the sheer relief of allowing your words to become light, responsive, and empty, born entirely from the simple, unobstructed desire to alleviate the suffering in front of you.
It would change everything.
What would it look like for your speech to finally become like a rainbow flashing effortlessly across the open sky? Take a moment to think about that.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts. From bodyarchive.org.